Hey, welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast directly from Manhattan Beach in California. And this is, I have no control over the sound environment whatsoever. There's literally construction, a new house 10 feet away here. And then about 7 feet away above my head, there's construction on an apartment. So deal.
No problem.
This podcast is designed for three things. We talk to comedians about their politics and their ideas, always fun. I talk to the right occasionally because I think they can use some adjustment back onto the rails of democratic process. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians, communication professionals to gather some training for people. Complicated times out there. We now need some more sophisticated techniques. I think we could all agree. I am Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, professional comedy writer out here in LA. And I just like to dig through the rhetoric. That's my background. And so that's what the podcast is all about. My guest today, really interesting guy. I had Jonathan Alba on here a few weeks ago, and he's been connecting me. He's been octopusing the arms out into the world. This is a guy I would say that kind of lives at the center of things from what I can tell on your bio. Coordinate producer for the Today Show during the Olympics for the past 16 years, directing the basic course at Texas State and teaching a wide range of courses in the Comm Studies and Honors program. Has worked with TEDx, co-founder of CoSearch Weekend, which we'll talk about. He's a professor all around, make things work in the real world kind of guy. Michael Burns.
Hi, good to be here. I'm happy. This is going to be fun.
You got kind of a chalkboard behind you. What is that? That gray?
It's just a gray wall.
Can you write on it? It looks like one of those chalk walls.
Yeah. No, it just I took things down when we moved into Zoom world. So it wasn't as distracting in the background when I had to record videos for class.
I like it. Yeah, good kind of a gray universe there receding behind you. Uh-huh. You know. So introduce yourself just a little bit. Just hit us with how you typically would introduce yourself because you've done so many things.
Yeah. Well, as you said, I'm Michael Burns. I am a professor. My main job, my main gig is I'm a professor at Texas State University where I teach a ton of different courses. I'm kind of the go-to generalist for a lot of things. But one of my big areas they have me focus on is career readiness for our students and trying to keep track of the what industry looks like and the value of the soft skill in industry now and why degrees like communication matter more than ever. So I'm on the forefront of that, developed, you know, our current career readiness program. It's kind of a new approach to what I believe how careers should be approached in college. So I do that. That's my kind of main gig. Like I said, like you said, I teach a variety of courses, everything from the intro course, 400 people, to I'm teaching a graduate course on corporate training and development now. So it kind of runs the gamut. But I have several side hustles that I like to call them. The one that has been going on the longest is with the Today Show, specifically on their Olympic team. I'm on their logistics and production management team specifically. And basically, we help coordinate everything that happens at an Olympic Games. I've done seven, most recently Beijing 2022 and Tokyo right before that in 2021. So I've done two COVID Olympics now, which that was a whole new experience. But basically what I do with those folks at the Today Show is we get there early. We research everything. We coordinate everything. We make sure we're following all the protocols. We send our team out to literally look at every venue. We time how much it takes to get between every place because in live television, every second is money. We learn the security routes, all those things so that we have a functioning news bureau and we understand everything once everyone else arrives. When they arrive, we're in charge of all athlete pickups and coordination. So I work with all of our guests that come on the show, whether they're an athlete or a chef or a dignitary. We coordinate all of that to make sure everything goes well, help the producers with whatever they need in terms of their segments. And then we stay and clean up. So I've been doing that. And that's changed a lot, obviously, since 2006 when I've started. And then I do a lot of training and development and consulting on the side with different corporations. Most recently, I've been working a lot with engineering executives who have never been really formally coached in communication, but they're in roles now where they're starting to realize how valuable it is. That's been, you know, kind of some fun fun work I've done there and some coaching. I do a lot of coaching with TEDx, and I help a lot of entrepreneurs with pitches and public speaking, right? So I'm kind of, I try to keep one foot in academia, one foot in industry, because I think, you know, for me to be best preparing my students, it's knowing what's going on out there. And, you know, I don't ever want to become that academic that gets so removed from reality. I'm a little clueless, and I know there are plenty of those that exist.
Wow. Yeah. There you go. Like I said, you've done a couple of things. You've got a few games running. So let's just jump in. Let's start with the career readiness stuff, because I think this hyperjuncture between pure academics, learning, you know, diving deep into things, and the application in the real world is kind of what I've run into a lot with rhetoric, and trying to get people more aware of what rhetoric offers, and even this kind of, you know, sort of new digital environment for politics and doing political persuasion, because there's so much over here. It's such a trove of information. We've been studying this for 2,500 years, and people don't even know it exists.
Yeah.
They don't even think the word is real. They don't think the academic degree is even, you know, viable. So talk about that a little bit, like living at that juncture, sort of moving back and forth like you have.
Yep.
Just sort of orient your experience of that so far.
So, you know, I'm one of those folks that I truly believe in the value of a liberal arts education. And, you know, I think that education for education's sake is important, but I also, we have to recognize that when a parent is sending their kid off to college, they want to know what jobs they're going to get, how much money they're going to make, all those things. And so that puts people like ourselves who study what we study in an interesting position, because when you graduate with a degree, there's not a job called rhetorician. There's not a job called communicator, right? Like those are skills and important ones that every industry needs and uses. And so for me, kind of how I approach it is letting them, kind of revealing to them the power that comes with this degree, and how you can take it and use it to shape your kind of pathway to a career that you're interested in. And yes, you know, I try to tell them, like, this is a good thing that there's not a job attached to it, right? Like, yes, if you study accounting, you're going to be an accounting. If you study nursing, you're going to be a nurse. Like, the best thing that's going to happen for you is with this degree is you're going to have options, because everything that you learn with this degree works in every organization, no matter what it is. There is value that will be added because of this. And then you can adapt. And plus, why are you wanting to choose a job for someone who doesn't exist yet? You know, I tell my 20-year-olds, 35-year-old you doesn't exist yet. How do you know in 15 years that's what you want to do, right? So, but we can teach you to use these communication skills, knowledge, theories that you're learning to constantly pivot and look for experiences and options and kind of do that. So, you know, I try to kind of show them that. And I always say, you can't get more applied than Aristotle, right? It's literally right. Since the beginning, right? We know that, like, this is how you are more persuasive. And to me, I believe that all communication is persuasion, and every interaction we have is persuasive, whether it's a job interview, whether it's talking with a client, whether it's, you know, trying to obviously get someone to buy something, you know, it doesn't matter, right? It's happening all the time. And it's been really fun, because I spent a whole summer going through hundreds and hundreds of our alumni LinkedIn pages just to see what they do. And I compiled this list of the most common things that they do. They're all in crazy different industries, but they're all doing communication things that are things like audience analysis and message development and negotiation and, you know, just in planning and problem solving. And those are all things that I believe a communication degree teaches you, right? It teaches you these skills that people have gotten also really bad at. And I think with kind of how technology has shifted, like, this is a really ripe time to study communication. I think we're getting to a point where people are recognizing the need for it, and why so many of their problems at work are communication related. And you're seeing more and more of that. You're even seeing the big tech companies recognize why, you know, social scientific research is beneficial and all of that. So I think, you know, that's been kind of my approach is how do I show them, like, if you pull up any job description, you're going to find communication in it, and that it's a value to not, to have something more general, right? Like the generalist, I say, in the long run always outperforms the specialist.
Yeah. Well, like you said there, I mean, the ability to constantly pivot. I sometimes describe what I've done because I've worked across, I started as a professor, you know, in education. I've taught for a long time. And at the same time, I was running a stand-up comedy writer, entertainment career concurrently. And then I pivoted over and started working with businesses, doing consulting and things like you're talking about. And so, like, in some ways, I call it pirouetting or pivoting like a ballerina. I mean, you're just, it never is going to stop. Well,
and probably in all those things you're doing a lot of the same things, right? Like the same skill set.
Yeah, it's message manipulation.
You know, exactly. And I think that's what, you know, you would never dream like, oh, like, what does this person who used to teach or consult doing with comedy, right? Like on surface level, that looks bizarre to people.
Yeah, but it the nice thing, like when you do go in and absorb an industry within the constructs that you've been taught in communication, you now have a new set of terminology.
Yep.
You have, and then you cross-pollinate. One of the things I've found, like you said, there's no job as rhetorician, but when I started a digital marketing agency in Austin, I made myself the master rhetorician. Yeah. So I'm the MRO of the organization. And it just starts everything in my world when somebody comes in, a client comes in, they're like, what's that? Yeah. As soon as they say that, well, I've got them. I've got them over here with Aristotle and this terminology and all the things that I know how to work as software.
Right. Labeling. It's so important, right?
Right? There you go. How about that? Yeah. And it's funny, you know, when you talk about this stuff to people, they look at you like, I can't believe this has been studied. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it turns out everything's been studied, and especially this, because it's like you said, it's in everything and studied really well. There's so much great work over in comm studies and rhetoric. And it's always frustrated me that it doesn't get out more commonly, you know, into the general curriculum and middle school, grade school, all that kind of stuff.
Well, and I think, you know, from that standpoint, most of our students, the first time they're introduced to it, maybe they did a speech class in high school, but that's about it, you know, and then they don't even know it exists or it's a possibility. And I think that's, you know, kind of fun in a lot of ways when you have them have that aha moment. I love, that's why I teach the basic course all the time.
Right.
Like a lot of people don't like teaching it. You know, they are like, oh, that's for grad students. I'm like, no, like that's where you hook them, right? Like that's where they first see the value in it. And, you know, it's fun to be able to kind of capture them that standpoint. But at the same time, I would even argue like our discipline, they haven't done a great job at putting it out there. In some ways it's like, I think we've tried to defend ourselves and why we are a true, you know, we belong in the academy and we're a true discipline. We are different than psychology. We're different than English. We're different than sociology. That sometimes that has caused us to also not let our findings and our research out into the real world. And you know, those of us that do that, right, benefit, you know, a lot from it, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's a good point. The odd part of rhetoric going away, you know, in the academy during the Middle Ages and, you know, sort of kind of coming back during the Renaissance is a lot of different things. And then in the industrial age, getting sort of co-opted by business and advertising and marketing and things like that. Again, people don't realize, and that's what I start. I have probably a whole set of hooks that I've got now of, you know, well, this has been studied for 2,500 years. You guys have about 100 years of mostly social science, you know, that's broken through. And then, you know, you look at the role of social science after World War II and it repressing everything else in the university, right? It's so dominant, the scientific method, and suddenly rhetoric and communication starts making itself look like social science. And I'm like, we're not going to win in that arena. They're in our arena, really, you know, so let's bring them back to what, you know, I would start with, which is we've dominated education for 2,500 years. So let's start with us.
I agree. And I think about, you know, when you were talking there, like none of the ways we study communication social scientifically would exist without without rhetoric. I mean, so many of the things we know about rhetoric is what they measure or try to measure, or the outcomes of our messaging. And that's how it started. But again, it's, to me, I was, when I did my PhD, I purposely chose a program where we were required to take an applied approach and talk about problems, let the problem dictate the method. And so, you know, there's times when, you know, I took rhetoric classes, I had to take my quantitative classes, my qualitative studies, all of that, right? Because if we're going to take this applied approach, we need to understand how these three areas of research or methods of research, I should say, work together. Because in the end, no matter what the solution is, or in terms of a communication perspective, you have to use rhetoric and what we know about rhetoric for anything that any of our numbers may have showed us. Those numbers don't make sense without rhetoric, and the solution will involve rhetoric, right? And so not siloing ourselves is important in that way. And, you know, I was lucky, I found a program. There's not many that will do that. But, you know, I chose specifically, and nobody just chooses to go to North Dakota. But, you know, the researchers who were there at the time let us do that and encourage that. And so I think that kind of has always stuck with me. And I think, you know, I loved all of my methods classes, but, you know, in the end, like, I definitely use my rhetoric background more than my survey background or even my, you know, interpretive class background.
Right. Yeah. University of South Florida was the same way. I'd gone to UT Austin for my master's degree in, you know, super traditional rhetoric design. Although some of those guys were kind of progressive, but, you know, really hardcore in its rhetoric. And then South Florida was a new PhD program, so they didn't have a full faculty yet to fill out all the PhD courses. So I took about a third of rhetoric, a third of cultural studies, and a third of interpersonal. Mm-hmm. And it was put together as a progressive program by Art Bachner, who had moved down there basically to, you know, run his own program after becoming disillusioned with comm studies from a quantitative perspective. So it had that kind of, like you're talking about, that permission to roam and to amalgamate from a lot of different things. And I remember running across, like, I took some sociology outside the department and having a discussion once in there about, they were calling it labeling theory, that, like, you know, if you, the label itself, you know, independent of the thing, tends to drive people. And I'm like, hey, you know, that's called rhetoric.
Yeah. This isn't new.
She was so, you know, like, this is amazing. I'm like, yeah, it is. But, you know, it's, we've got it. Go get it.
Right. Yeah, I laugh because I was actually a couple of weeks ago working with some engineers, and, you know, a lot of what I was doing with them was public speaking related, and just, you know, really basic, you know, what someone like ourselves would see is really basic rhetoric, like the stuff you teach at the entry level undergrad courses. And man, and it was like, I was like, they were like, they made a joke. They were like, this is like some kind of hidden dark magic. What, this makes so much sense. And it was really funny because it was like, just like the structure of an argument, you know? And you would have, and, you know, I'm talking to the executives, and they thought I was just this amazing, like, brilliant human. I'm like, well, none of this is like mine. I'm just sharing what other people have done for centuries, and also what my freshmen and sophomores do, you know? And they're happy to pay to learn it. Great. Awesome. Obviously I'm happy to do it too, but it was really, even in these men who've been in this company for years and years and years, seeing these like light bulbs go off, and then like, oh, and then they started thinking of the mistakes, like, that's why that messaging did this, or, you know, it was just hilarious, like, watching, literally, it was like watching the brain go click, 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 uh-oh, I get it now.
Well, and you made the point, most people take public speaking at some point, and that's really, they don't understand there are 100 other rhetoric courses behind that,
right?
That they don't understand that's intro to rhetoric. And, you know, this idea that we learn most of our communication clearly through an informal absorption pattern in culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of instruction built into culture about, oh, don't, you know, say please, you know, all things like that, which are actually informal communication structures. But then when you get over into the formal system and you're like, oh, look what's possible over here. If you really organize all this learning and really pull in all these different writers and thinkers, that's what I think blows people's minds when they see the depth of what's been done.
Right. Well, and you know, it speaks to a lot of things. I think with adults, I know my college students are technically adults, but with folks who are, more higher functioning adults outside of the college environment, I think they have the life experience too, to see the value in it. And sometimes it's like, maybe we go to school too early in that regard, right? Because they love it. They're on it. And they're like, I wish I would have even thought about taking these courses or in school. And I want to know more. And, I always think sometimes we need to introduce this stuff, maybe even just later in the college career when it is a little more, meaningful when they're looking for jobs and thinking about that and having to talk and represent themselves. But, I always laugh like, yeah, you probably did take something like this at college and you paid for it and you just did not retain it all the time.
Well, and that motivated learning, that's one of the things I like about teaching interpersonal, is because everybody's been through relationships, and for the younger students, you center it in their parents. For the little bit older students, you center it in their marriages. And you can just see it, just like you said, the light bulb just exploding in their minds about, oh, that's why, that's why I couldn't make this point, or why, this person always got frustrated with me, because they hadn't been taught, again, in a formal sense. I have two kids, and my son, I did some training with him, some interpersonal training with him once he'd had his second girlfriend. And I could tell something was going wrong. He was being quiet. And it turns out he wanted to break up with her, but he didn't know how.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, this is just an interpersonal communication training. So let's train you how to break up with somebody well, and you just take them through it. Like, here's a bunch of different options, but the one, tell her how you actually feel. You don't have to manage it too much. Just say honestly how you feel, and this isn't working for you. And don't get off that script.
And don't do it via text.
Like all that stuff. But it's like, he did it and he's like, oh, that actually worked. I'm like, yeah, that's the nice thing about formal learning, if it's done well, is it actually works.
Yep, exactly.
So I'm sure you run into that a lot where, because you work so much, it seems like, with students and, getting them with all the career readiness stuff of how do you do this sort of, you get general training, but how do you turn that into, hey, you guys should hire me because I can do these particular things?
Yeah, I think, for me, I always try to explain to them that somebody with a background in communication and rhetoric, you're trainable, right? And so all of these skills make you trainable. And think about most people, whatever job they get, they walk in, they got to be trained anyways. Even if they have one of those degrees that result in a very specific job, they still have to have on the job training. And so you become this trainable person, this learner, right? That is able to listen critically, think about how to apply it, ask the right questions, and you become kind of a student of the organization in many ways. But you also, because you have, I think, that critical eye and that critical ear to know where and identify the gaps and identify your own gaps in the knowledge for that matter too. And one of the alum that I work pretty closely with, she always talks about, she works in for a giant mortgage company, and she's in charge of their kind of professional and people development area of it. And she said, no, I love calm people. I can teach. It's easy to teach them real estate and mortgage. That's easy. But when I get someone that only knows mortgages and things, it takes me years to get them up to where I need them to be from a communication standpoint. Right. So it is so much easier to just find someone that knows nothing about mortgages, but understands people and messaging, because it just clicks and it's easier, there's a right and a wrong with mortgages, right? Everything we do is in the gray, and it's going to be different with every interaction.
Hey, little producer note. I think you're bouncing your mic a little.
Oh, is it? Sorry.
when you're talking. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Yeah, I think that sense of being well trained so that you're improvising is effective is one of the things that I talk to people about with this stuff. That sure, there's learning script and being able to follow the script and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the real value is that your skills are heightened kind of to the point where you can now improvise across situations, bring those skills to bear, but do it at a level that, you know, you don't drop off too much from highly scripted, you know. And I think it's one of the things I learned doing stand-up for so long. Like, I started doing stand-up in my early 20s. And I've done stand-up everywhere, like biker bars to high-end corporate events. And I typically don't really do script anymore because it's so much more fun to just talk to people in the moment. And I'm so trained with comedy writing. My brain does it so fast. It applies the technique so fast now that I can usually, you know, hit a pretty high bar just almost instantly. And so it's just more fun, and it adds that extra element of being authentically in the moment instead of acted in the moment. But I think students get the same thing. Like, once they've been through enough iterations and courses and where they start to absorb these things, they do gain a confidence because they know they can improvise their way through almost any situation.
Yeah. And, you know, it's essentially what you're talking about, I think, is audience analysis, right? The whole time, right? And that you've done it enough, like you said. And so your brain kicks in and you know what to pick up on and understand and look at, you know, look at your audience and adapt accordingly. You can read their responses to different jokes, I'm sure. And you're right. Like, with the students, it's really getting them to be that perceptive and kind of other oriented, I guess, is another way to put it. Right. And that, I mean, that's where a lot of the, I think the value comes into play with their background and wherever they're at. Like, I always say, our students get promoted quickly. They a lot of times start at the same spots as a lot of people, but they get promoted quickly because they get that they're doing exactly what you're talking about on stage. They're just doing it in this different context. And you're right. It's the same skill set. And that's what I love about it, is that I can walk into any situation and adjust and make it work. And, you know, and some people think like, well, is that manipulative? I'm like, no, you know, like, there's a fine line, right? You got to know that, and the ethical side of things, but you're adapting to make sure the conversation goes well, and that you are, I mean, everybody wants something out of a conversation. That's just the reality of it all. And you can address that and navigate through it and kind of adapt as you go. And I think that's, for a lot of folks and a lot of other degrees, you know, I always joke that when you get my friends that got MBAs, they always look for the one right way to do something. And a lot of times they fail because the one way they tried, or they spent so much time looking for the one perfect way, they lost, you know, valuable resource and time and all of that kind of stuff. And so I think with people with our backgrounds, they know, like, all right, we can dive in and continue to pivot. It's kind of like that experiment and adjust idea. And, you know, that's not necessarily taught in other disciplines.
Right. Well, and it's interesting carrying the rhetoric torch out into different areas like I do, where maybe people haven't really heard it, or what they've heard about it is the negative, you know, manipulation techniques within rhetoric, which are a subset of rhetoric. It's always been there. It's totally possible to use those things. And then instantly when they hear rhetoric or they hear persuasion, they become suspicious because it's organized and it's formalized. Yeah. And there's a method here, and you're thinking about this without telling me what you're thinking about. And I'm like, well, I understand that, you know, that can be manipulation, but 95% of the time, that's me trying to figure out how to communicate effectively.
Right.
I care enough about you to adjust my message before I send it to you so that it'll be effective with you. You know,
right.
It's not me trying to force you away from what, where you would be, you know, authentically or ethically. It's me doing the work, you know, on the message before I send it, because I know how to do that.
Well, there's a dark side to everything, right? I mean, it's just, no matter what field you pick up or go into, there's a dark side to it. And I think, I mean, we even teach a class called Dark Side in our department now, you know, where we point these things out that like, this is what makes something problematic. And, you know, why we, in our definition of what we believe a competent communicator is, we bring in these ethical ideas. But to be honest, it is the rhetoric and cultural and critical studies that does that best, right? That allows you to really think through that. And so I think in a lot of ways, you know, we're more equipped, our students are more equipped to handle those type of situations that could possibly go into more of that manipulation line and hopefully avoid it. Like you said, 99% of the time, it probably doesn't go that way.
Yeah, and it's one of the things I do on the rhetoric brand. One of the reasons I moved to California was to start an ethical persuasion institute, because one of the things I do within the brand of taking rhetoric out to people who haven't really used it or heard it is this idea of ethical only rhetoric is what we're striving for. And if you look in politics, I don't care what your content is. It makes no difference how you think Americans should be or live our lives or organize or the laws we want to pass. What matters is how you try to get those in place. And if you're using unethical techniques, unethical rhetoric techniques, then you are in the wrong in a democracy. Now, you may argue these have always been used, but they're never used in the way that they're being used. They're being amplified, super amplified, and people don't know how to defend against them. And so if you just get outside the content and hang out in technique, you can get into some interesting discussions and avoid some of the baggage that occurs. Like, people are like, well, you're a liberal. I'm like, I'm not a liberal or a conservative. I'm a rhetorician, which means I'm looking at the architecture here. I'm looking at the software being used and deciding, is this good for a democracy or not? And then we can have a conversation about it, sans your attachments. Right. I don't care.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I always talk about how, you know, we're in a weird, and I don't teach the political classes. It's not necessarily my background, but obviously we should all somewhat be involved politically, I believe. But, you know, just the last 10 years and watching how politics have evolved, I mean, right there in terms of how both sides in many ways communicate and approach situations or attack, however you want to label it, you know, those are folks that would probably value from mm-hmm. courses like ours. And it's sad because, you know, the discourse isn't happening. The healthy debates, you know, that's how we make progress. And I think, you know, for me, that's another big motivator to teach what I teach, is to try to respect that and bring that back to our society. So, I think you're totally right. Like, somebody who's a rhetorician can approach neutrally, especially if you're looking at the argument of the debate of what's happening.
Yeah, and I have a friend, Bill Keith, who published a book recently on getting back to civil discourse and civil argument in our politics. And I had him on here and we talked about it. And I'm like, I don't think that's the game right now. I mean, civil and this idea of hyper-rational and nonviolent and, you know, those kind of discussion things have driven democracy. They're clearly a strand within democracy, and they're something that we've found value in. But they also make everything vulnerable to the other side of that. Like, if you don't defend against something like mass deception on a point, if you have nothing in your armory other than, hey, you know, we need to get back to civil discourse. I'm like, no, they're not going back to civil discourse. They found an advantage. And rhetorically, I'm not even judging it. I think it's unethical discourse, damaging to a democracy. But what I'm interested in as a rhetorician is, how do you counter program it? You know, they're not going to stop using an advantage. People rarely do. But, and so if you don't counter program, that's your fault.
Right. And, you know, in many ways, I guess main sources to help counter that is a liberal arts education. But a lot of that is lost, I think, in our current education system in a lot of ways. And, you know, and that kind of brings me to the point too of, and you may get a sense of this when you kind of hear my bio and background, of a lot of my frustrations with higher ed and where it's at and, you know, what we are really serving and kind of this consumer model. And it worries me in a lot of ways because I see, you know, these shifts that are getting more to this kind of inflammatory kind of ideas and responses and quick wins and zingers, whatever you want to, you know, call them. And, you know, that's the type of stuff that sometimes keeps me up at night as an educator and makes me think like, man, some of these academics are getting it wrong. Like we need to, this is our time to kind of help like preserve things or move things forward or get the pendulum to swing a little bit back to some middle ground. And you know, there's just not the value. I don't think people see the value in education that way and what the purpose of an education is serving. And, you know, and I think we're going to see, we're starting to see the problem with that and kind of that way of thinking. And like Pat, like in the past, it'll shift hopefully and we'll get back to that middle ground. But we are, at least in my opinion, on the way far end of that pendulum swing at the moment.
Yeah, and it's like you said, in some ways, the science orientation and then the occupation, you know, orientation within education, there's only so much time and so much resource over here to be a really good citizen and uphold your democracy and keep, you know, these, your society in place and evolving and innovating. Those, you know, that is not the lead dog in the university anymore.
Not at all. Not at all. And programs across the country are losing funding or under attack for it. You know, people in our field at most universities are some of the lowest paid in comparison. It's true at Texas State. It's true at most of my colleagues at other institutions. You know, we are the bottom of the barrel in terms of our pay. And, you know, to me, that's a symbol of how they view what we study and believe and can function. But, you know, we know that STEM, for example, it's a lot faster grant money, a lot faster money that comes in that way. And it, you know, to your point, same thing with the business colleges, they're usually up there, right, as well. And it's frustrating because so I get frustrated. I see a lot of other departments and other units and colleges trying to, or claiming, I should say, doing what we do and they don't. And it's, and they don't do it well. And in some ways it could be dangerous in terms of how they approach this as well. And, you know, we would never send, you know, engineers out without the proper training. But we have no problem sending people out where words can literally start and end wars, have no problem sending people out with no training in that area. And it scares me. And sometimes it's like, I always say, like, I understand that saying of ignorance is bliss. You know, it'd be a lot easier for me to not notice those things.
Well, again, stand up, the art of the little, you know, flourishes within stand up. I just can't not use them. They're so much a part of me. But I remember somebody saying ignorance is bliss. And I'm like, yeah, unless it's, you know, sitting next to you in a cubicle. You know, yeah. Unless it's your boss, then it's horrible.
Yeah. You know?
But it is this idea that, you know, we aren't trained to deal with, even Americans have never liked politics. We've been incredibly lucky in the fact that we've had a stable society forever, and we've never really had to do politics. This is the first time, I think, at least in a long time, where the society has become more unstable through political action and political conflict, and people don't have the skills in order to come into these situations. And that's part of the reason why I got frustrated with universities and sort of, you know, bailed out around 2000 after teaching off and on for a long time. And I love teaching, and I've always enjoyed students because I come from a working class background. So it's built into me to go back and lift up the community once you've been lifted up. It makes no sense to just keep going by yourself, you know, at least in that working class communal mentality. So I always wanted to be able to do that, but you end up in the side of the forces of grading and these students not being forced to take courses they're not ready for or don't want. And, you know, all that kind of, and then the legalism of they're challenging grades. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. This is not what I signed up for. And so that's why when I look at something like an external kind of an extant ethical persuasion institute for adults, I don't want it to be attached to a university. I just can't take those fights anymore. I want it to be something like you can do training, you can come get training. It's agnostic. And it's also aggressive. Like it doesn't have to make everybody happy. You know, the way you get caught in the university where it's like, oh, I would tell this student this, but I know what that's going to come back and do to me. Right. So, you know, some type of independence where you get that sort of freedom, I think, to say a little bit more of what you actually would say, if you could.
Yeah, I think that's why I like doing the training and development stuff and the consulting stuff, because you get that freedom to do that. But, you know, a lot of times those adults want the feedback and there's ways to deliver it. And, you know, I had a conversation this week with a grad student. I said, just because it's hard doesn't mean it's wrong, right? It's supposed to be hard. And yeah, this isn't good work. And here's why. It's not that I'm saying you're not a good person. I'm just saying your right. work was not good. And it's a hard separation for them to see that. And you're right. Luckily, people like us who study words, we can be very particular and focused on how we write feedback and whatnot. But, you know, in a lot of ways, these frustrations and things we're talking about, it's, you know, I always joke, I'm like the anti-academic who keeps himself in like this like place that drives me nuts. I don't know if I'm just trying to like change it from the inside or destroy it from the inside, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, even like you mentioned co-search and stuff, like there's just so many problems and you can kind of see like tenure, for example, like that system is messed up. It's not used for what it was intended to be used for. And, you know, I'm not tenure track and I'm purposely not tenure track because I have much more power and freedom to do what I want to do, research what I want to research, publish what I want to publish without a clock and without them telling me what I have right. to do. And there are a lot of folks who are really bothered by that, that I have turned down to be even switched over to the tenure track because I lose the power in a lot of ways. And I don't want that. And to be honest, the tenure raise isn't even that much. So there's not even a lot of financial gain from it. And then it also just becomes this, to me, let's produce, you know, studies that, all right, there's some findings, but they're not that groundbreaking or, you know, they're not really having that much of an impact or if no one reads them, but you're just worried about this kind of line on your vita to get it as long as possible. Like, what's the point of it all, right? What is the point? And so I don't want to get caught up in that either. And so it's been an interesting journey in terms of academia for me, because I don't do it a traditional way. And I've gotten a lot of crap for it. I mean, I've been at conferences where people have literally told me I'm wasting my PhD. And you're like, really? Like,
doesn't feel like it.
Yeah, because you're also in education. And is more education ever a problem? Even if I didn't want to be a professor, if I got a PhD to serve drinks out of pineapples on a beach, am I really like wasting it? You know, it's an interesting kind of dynamic, but I guess too, it's a threat to a system that has existed. And, you know, we know people don't like, you know, people who shake up the systems and stuff. And, you know, and that was the whole point of co-search and the things that I do. It's like, let's recognize like, all right, we can function within this crazy tenure system, but why don't we work together to try to kind of use interdisciplinary studies and partner with the engineer, partner with the whoever to make an impact and to make research that matters. And it's kind of funny because there's folks that are all about it, but the majority of folks, they avoid it. They're like, you know, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, you know? And it's an interesting place to be. I think about all the time, what is the future? I don't know if I'll stay in education forever. I'm on public student loan forgiveness and they're forgiven in November. So those shackles will be gone where I will have more options if I want to stay or go, I don't know. But it's just we're at a fascinating time in education because we're getting to a tipping point and something's got to give. And maybe it'll be for good or bad. I hope it's for the better for the system.
Yeah, I, you know, like sort of, when I bailed out of university teaching. I always did adult ed, you know, usually within fairly innocuous things like teaching crowd work or comedy writing or, you know, a stand-up course where people were taking it out of a genuine interest or a curiosity and not because there was anything on the line or there was anything organizationally that needed to be satisfied. And I really enjoy that type of teaching where it has specific motivation to be used instantly. And I tell people a lot of times that kind of learning is pretty amazing. I used to run a workshop at Charlie Goodnight's Comedy Club in North Carolina. It's a great comedy club. And they wanted people to be vetted before they would let them on their open mic nights, just to make sure they were, you know, not going to totally blow up the place. And so I ran auditions a couple hours before the open mic, and people would come in and they would do something. And I'd be like, okay, well, if I were you, I would drop these three jokes or whatever, because the audience won't get that. And they'd be like, oh, you know, okay. And then they'd disregard my advice and go up and do it. But the feedback that an audience gives you is so powerful. Yes. And so definitive. Silence at the joke you thought was funny, but it told you wasn't, you know, is a great teacher. It's like, there's no need to evaluate you, is there?
That's terrible in a classroom when I make a joke and no one laughs, but maybe most times they're not listening. I don't know, but it is terrible. You're like, oh, okay. That didn't go over well.
They come back. They're like, oh, I see why you're valuable. I
think stand-up comedy is the scariest and hardest thing ever. So more power to anyone who even tries it, because that is... that I think that is one thing that I would be honestly scared to even try. So more power to you.
That's funny. I'm just the opposite. Like, it's so much easier to be able to use humor to charm an audience and can, you know, get the effects you want. So much easier, like, than actually having to do the work to educate or, you know, to think your way through something. Like, oh yeah, I can just delight you people and we're all fine, right? Nobody's challenged. And
that's true.
I think so. Talk a little bit more about the co-search thing. Because I saw that and I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Yeah. So co-search is a program, an experience where we follow kind of the startup weekend model. If you've heard of, like, you know, startup weekends where they start a business in 3 days and they pitch it, they do the pitch competition. And I went to one as a judge and a pitch coach. And when I was sitting there listening to this and watching what they do, I thought, why can't we do this with research? And it's a great way to build community and to impact the community and get people out of their silos. Like, let's try this. And so I basically was inspired by that to create this research startup program, is essentially what we called it, and called it CoSearch. Like, that's in it, you know, we have this center of collaboration that I worked through, and that's kind of where the co stuff came into play. And what we do is we get researchers and artists from basically faculty from all over the university, and I've done this at other universities too. They all come, they pitch an idea, kind of this pie in the sky idea of, like, how they want to make some community impact, some research they've always wanted to do, whatever it is, but they know they need help from outsiders. And they pitch the idea, and then we go through voting processes and we narrow it down, and the teams form, and then they spend the rest of the weekend working on a research proposal about whatever the topic is that they're researching. And then they pitch it to a community So we open up the pitches to the community. We have judges, both academic and industry, that come and listen to it. And then, you know, they award the teams, the winning teams, some money, some seed money to get started on these projects. And, you know, it's been kind of cool because projects, some of our projects, like, for example, we have a food bank on Texas State's campus now, because there was this issue with a lot of our students are food insecure. Even pre-COVID, we are a university community where most of our students they're not from wealthier backgrounds like some of the other state schools in Texas. And, you know, we noticed this, you know, our students are hungry. And it was interesting because it was music professors, marketing professor, and some artists and an engineer that came up with this way for us to track students who need our help and find a way, a non-judgmental way, to get them food so they can be, eat. And it helps our community. It's there and it's been functioning for years. We had another group of communication, English, a sports psychiatrist, and a theater person come up with this living mental wellness program that they are literally traveling the world doing this living mental wellness for folks in terms of how do they manage their stress, and specifically with artists and athletes, because there's a lot of similarities in terms of what they struggle with. And so we just found kind of a mechanism and created an experience where we get them in the room and we kind of have to break their brains a little bit, even. Like, we do really weird stuff up front, like kind of artist kind of based things. We have kind of exercises, kind of like I call them summer camp exercises, just to like kind of break the academic ego down a little bit. Sure. Like, we don't care all your publications. Let's get past all that. And then it's just like a really fun, productive weekend. And it basically jumpstarts the process, and really cool projects come out of it and the requirement that there has to be community impact of some sort. And so we've been doing this for 7 years now, and I've done it at other universities. We've had a TEDx talk about it. I've helped groups in India and Brazil kind of develop similar ideas of basically faculty collaboration. It's resulted in grants and things. So it was a way to kind of do research that matters, but also meet the needs of the university in terms of publication and grant funding.
Well, that's great. I mean, so much of university work is internal, you know, right? It's isolated. It's you with your ideas, and you work on it and polish it to the point where now I'll kind of expose it and try to get grant money and things like that. And again, the parallels between entertainment, people do screenplays. Like, I was a panelist for years at the Austin Film Festival and would read their incoming scripts and judge the finals of their TV script contest. And, you know, they had 4,000 to 5,000 people submit screenplays from all over the world. And most of these people had just sat down. The nice thing about being a writer is you don't need actors. You don't need a stage. You don't need anybody's permission. Hey, I'm going to write a screenplay. And, you know, I read, I would say 95% of the ones that I read, just, they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
They had put 120 pages of effort forth, but they hadn't learned what a movie story was. They hadn't learned all the different elements that make, you know, a screenplay work. And I taught screenwriting for a while, and it's a massive endeavor to make it good. It's a massive endeavor to even make it bad, yeah. Which I'm like, I felt so bad for them because I'm like, I know what this took, yep. But you were working on your own instead of exposing this early on to somebody who could say, hey, the screenplay has to do 20 things. Let's just check it, recheck it, and make sure it's doing those things before you spend all this time, you know, driving it home and thinking it's finished when it's 7% finished. And you now have no energy left to do the rest of the work on it. And so just giving people that, you know, externalizing that internal process sounds like a really strong thing to do in a university.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you're right. You described the academic, they sit and do it all on their own. And, you know, the funny thing was the benefits that came from it that we weren't expecting, of just friendships, retention of faculty. They've assimilated, a lot of new faculty do it to get to know people. You know, relationships matter. We know that. And they did side projects. A lot of the projects that didn't get to the final voting round, people were like, I want to do that. Let's talk afterwards. Those would get done. And it just was a way to kind of get people out there and have these kind of unintended positive consequences that we didn't expect. We invite the community in, and internships were born out of it. And it was just like it's been a fun way to get people connected. And, you know, we had COVID and things. And so like that happened again. So now it's, you know, kind of the excitement's back for it because people haven't seen each other in 2 years. And so it's been fun. We did it last year this past fall. So September, and the people, you know, we actually had a theme this year, and everybody came forward like, hey, can we have a theme? We want to get everyone together who wants to focus on diversity and inclusion. And so we even did a theme this year. And then you found these folks from, you know, it was really cool to see how engineers and how nurses and how communication folks, English folks, theater folks, you name it, approach diversity and inclusion. And like these ideas of these programs, they're just so much richer and better just because, like you said, there's just endless amounts of knowledge out there. You know, I really don't believe that there's a problem out there that can't be solved. We just need to connect and kind of get out of our heads a little bit, you know, like anything's possible. Like that's the beauty of being human and the power of our you know, brains to be creative. And it's been a fun way to hopefully, you know, make a little bit of an impact in, you know, the craziness that is the society we live in.
Well, you know this from working in TV, that I explain, like, you know, the cross-pollination between the way TV produces messages versus academics versus business. I've made a living in those three, moving back and forth and shuffling things between those quite a bit for the last 20 years. And in TV, you know, nobody would ever just do something themselves. You know, it's always super committee work. You can't do all of this. I worked in talk shows for a long time, and you show up in the morning and there is no show. Right. And by, you know, 4:30 or whatever the time of the taping, there has to be an hour long show. So 45 minutes material or so, and every bit of it has to be perfect and every bit of it has to be good. You know, so the amount of people that know how to coordinate what they do, and their expertises to bring it together on one message, to get it hyper produced in that, and 5 days a week, you know, 42 weeks a year or so, you see what they've done to streamline it, you know, and to avoid mistakes and to be able to quickly fix mistakes when they happen. Yeah. Nothing is left to chance because it can't be. But then you go over into business, we're like, well, let's just have a brainstorming meeting. I'm like, you're killing me. Like, you're going to have non-creatives come into a creative meeting? Why would you do that? And academics, that lone wolf, brilliant researcher, thinker, sitting alone, figuring it all out. It's a great mythology, but what is possible if, you know, you have a committee of people working on that? And screenplays the same way. Almost every screenplay is written probably by 10 people, really.
Right. So, yeah. Think about how much it shapes in, or shifts and changes. And, you know, and even these projects we do at CoSearch, they pitch something, but they are so different at the end and they're better. Yeah. Right. And, you know, like you're right. Like in the Today Show, like we don't have a show until, like, cause it's a news show. The mm-hmm. first 2 hours are news and we don't know what's going to happen overnight or overseas and there's literally people around the world working on this show so that it can continue to produce what needs to be produced. And I think for me, I mean, I've been doing this for a while with them. I remember when I first started, I interned there in 2005 before the Olympics. I remember being there my senior year in New York City, watching this go down and think, how does this even happen every day? This show get off the ground and on the air every day? And it does. Cause when you start, it's just fascinating to me. And like, I mean, that's where I fell in love with logistics, because the parts have to talk, they have to mesh. And when they don't, right, the cool thing is they know it so well that somebody can jump in and save it. There's always mistakes and here and there, and you've worked in television, you know what mistake happened, and most times the viewer has no clue, right? But it's because this well-coordinated group of humans have perfected this, that everyone knows how they fit. And what they're playing. But I also know your role enough that if you drop the ball, I can be like, hey, you dropped the ball. Like, here's this, right? Let me help. Where can I jump in? And I love it. Like, it's like this kind of, you know, say what you want about media and whatnot. Like, it is what it is. And like, but all shows, whether you like them or not, they are a beautiful orchestra in terms of how it all fits together. And that's why they're successful for, you know, whatever audience it is. And that's always been like so fun for me. And from a comm perspective, I don't have a journalism background. I've never taken a journalism class, but I work in news, in sports. I teach sports comm now because I do this, but I never took a sport comm class. I just like the Olympics. Here we are. But that education there, like, it's amazing. And like, you just kind of fall in love with it and you get a rush and the problem solving. And then, you know, you come back and, you know, I apply a lot of those principles to what I do, you know, at the university level. I mean, universities move slowly, but it's sometimes people are in awe of like, how did you even think to know that or ask those questions or know that that would happen? It's, well, it's kind of ingrained in me now. I didn't know that at first, but through and watching these amazing, smart people do it, it's amazing. I love how television functions. I love it.
Yeah, I do too. And I think sort of my subspecialty within all that is kind of the super creativity, you know, the sort of comic level stand-up, like stand-ups write lines that I describe as invulnerable jokes that no matter where you tell them or pretty much whoever tells them, they're going to work because they're so well crafted. They're so perfectly polished that really you walk onto stage once you've done all the work and you've just got, you know, bomb at their bomb at their bomb, and it just explodes and people laugh, you know, harder than they ever have for 45 minutes when it's done correctly. And that super creativity to tell people, like, I do a lot of foundational symbol work, brand work for businesses to either revitalize their brand because it can't compete, you know, in this sort of dense environment, or a lot of startups where it's engineers or somebody and they're like, we're going to call it. And I'm like, I don't think you should. You know, I don't think you should call it that because nobody knows what that means and they can't even spell it or say it. Right. Like, we had a software engineering company come in that was named Mezzohanian. And it was a portmanteau of two of the founders' names. And I'm like, okay. I said, and it had been in place for like 10 years. I'm like, what's the reaction with that? People are like, what? I'm like, yeah, you know that, that what? That's not a good reaction to your foundational symbol. Yeah, I just had a
flashback to Mesopotamia, learning about that in sixth grade that I have not thought about. But when you said that, that's what I was like, I haven't thought about that city or that ancient class now long.
So, you know, it's that sense of like, and a lot of times when I would consult at the C-level, I would say, you know, I have my humor sort of break icebreakers with them. And I'm like, well, I know you're all super smart, but you've all got SPS, which is smart people syndrome. You can figure things out. So now you think you can participate in them. I'm going to bring people in here to do linguistic creativity work, and they're going to be idiots half the time, but their brains are just ping pong balls with words. And they're going to come up with things you would never think of. And that's what you want. That's where you get your uranium and creativity. And so, you know, getting them again, like oriented to, oh, I'm a business, but look what I can harvest from something like TV process and that kind of creativity. It's an interesting cross-pollination pitch.
Yeah, I love that idea. Like, you know, that metaphor of cross-pollination, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I use people look at my resume and what I do and it's very much related actually. And it makes, when I explain it, it makes complete sense. But you know, at that surface level, they're like, why? Like, you know, I was told once, at a job interview, I didn't get the job and I asked why. And they said, oh, well, you just seem like a jack of all trades. And, you know, master of none. And I'm like, well, it's better than a master of one. So like, and here's, let me explain to you, you know, and it was an interesting kind of conversation when I asked for the feedback about why I didn't get the job. And, you know, it ended up being a blessing in disguise because they would have never let me do, what I do probably. But, you know, I love it when I, you know, I'm very lucky. I have a boss right now that sees the value in this cross-pollination and sees that, you know, that's where creativity and innovation is born. You know, you don't get inspired sitting and looking at the same stuff over and over again, right? And just exposing myself to television, to other, through co-search, other disciplines, or, you know, working with engineers, working with whoever, all these different like TEDx people and TED Talks I've coached. I don't know anything about their subject matters. I just got done coaching a meteorologist. I don't know anything about that, but you know, it's just so fascinating. And you know, that process, the calm process works, and his speech was great and he loved it and he's happy and he's better for it. And he knows he's a better communicator now, but you know, it doesn't matter. Like that exposure, like taught me, you know, just I thought of things and realized things, and kind of like, even when I read now or teaching class, there's stuff that kind of comes to mind that I know if I didn't have that experience with the meteorologist per se, I would have never thought of. And, you know, like, that's, I think, what gets me excited and about being fine. Call me a jack of all trades. I'll do it. Right. Like I say yes to a lot of things because I'm just curious. And
right.
I think
you know, and that's crazy that that's an insult, that that's somehow a lesser way of going through the world, because most creativity, when you break it down, you know, is literally cross-pollination. You're not coming up with something new. You're hauling in something, you know, from the 14th century that you read in a poem. You're like, oh, there's a weird original idea.
There's no original ideas. They all were born out of another idea.
Right. But now it's the mixing and matching is where the genius is. And I think, you know, I talk to people about abductive logic a lot, the ability to, you know, pull things together, not in a linear way from like, you know, deductive and inductive, that cluster abductive logic. And that's what comedians are great at. They can make connections between things instantly that are, you know, eons apart, and find the little similarity and suddenly crush them together to suddenly you got an insight. And you're like, wow, how did that happen? Well, you know, really good abductive minds, when you feed them like that and you allow them to roam across different areas, they're just collecting. And you get so much payoff from that, that it's really crazy that they don't understand that that's that is a super skill.
Right.
You know,
I agree. And I wish, you know, I'm to the point now where you find the places that see that, right? And like, that's, I think you learn as you get older. And I tell my students this, you find the folks that will let you express yourself, let you try things, let yourself take risks. They let you fail, let you try things. And, you know, that's where I want to be. And, you know, I've been fortunate that I have folks at the Today Show that let me try things. I have, you know, fortunate that my current boss at the university does. I'm fortunate that, you know, there's some industries out there that are willing to take a risk on me and try it. Right. And you get excited about those things. And, you know, you want to find kind of those organizations. I at least look for them that kind of let you get out of your way and set yourself free. And it's been a lot of fun. I've been, you know, very fortunate. And I talk about some of these opportunities I've had. I've literally traveled the world. And a lot of times it's just because I was curious, I said yes. But, you know, when those people do those things for you, you also are loyal. Like I want to do right by these folks too, because they gave me this chance and they've taught me something, and there's value added for me. And then you become a very loyal human to trying to help them out. And
see,
it's fun.
Seems like it all works, right? Like that you create this nucleus of people who let people do things, and you get good ideas and good work out of it. And here we go.
Maybe we should be the ones running Washington.
Clearly. That's my point, is vote for us. Well, it's been awesome, man. I really appreciate you jumping on. Jonathan has hooked me up with really interesting people. I talked to Greg Pogue a little bit last week, and so I love networking. I love, like I used to do when I lived in Austin, I'll start this at some point in LA. I did gatherings of interesting people. Like every 6 months, I would invite everybody I'd met for the last 6 months, that's artists, cool, comics, business, academics. And I would write bios for everybody and publish those beforehand, so you knew who everybody was. And the only rule is you had to talk to every single person at the party at some point. And it's just this crazy intersection of human energy. And that's kind of what the podcasts are for me. So I really appreciate you jumping on.
I appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. I love having conversations like this. So it was a good time. And when you start throwing those in LA, send me an invite to one. I'll fly out and do it, because that sounds like a super fun opportunity and a way to meet interesting people. I love it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And I gave a prize for the craziest personal story that was told at some point during the night. And it was usually a comedian that won it, but oh my God, so much fun.
I love it. Awesome. Well, thanks again for having me. I appreciate this.
Yeah. And everybody go check out Michael at Texas State, and, you know, hire him to do some consulting with you, and he'll take you through a lot of really cool stuff. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Dr. Dan saying, get out there and persuade people. As always, you know, they need it.